Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Before the earthquake, Henri Lejeune was an electrician in Port-au-Prince. Now he pulls scrap metal out of the rubble to make a living.
We can't even make a fourth of what we used to be able to make. We're just doing this work for now, until we see what God has planned for us.
Fortune telling with a parrot in Pakistan. And in New York, victims of domestic violence get free makeovers.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is so nice.
I just wanted to make sure that
Oh, you did wonderfully.
Oh, you look gorgeous.
Thank you.
Your makeup still
I look
nice
like
and
another
light.
A different person.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. More than a month after the earthquake, Haiti is in the middle of a massive cleanup effort. Piles of rubble from collapsed buildings are finally being cleared. Some Haitians are actually making a living sorting through the rubble before it gets hauled to the dump. Our reporter Grant Fuller met a father of five who's feeding his family by salvaging scrap metal.
A dump truck rumbles into a rocky clearing on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. Men and boys climb onto it and peer inside. They're looking for any sign of metal, because metal means money. An avalanche of crushed concrete, rocks, and dirt falls to the ground. Aurélas Jean looks disheartened.
This is just concrete debris. There's no steel, so there's nothing in there for us.
Ever since the earthquake, Jean has been here, salvaging and then selling steel reinforcing bars, rebar for short, that he finds in the rubble.
Maybe the next truck will come with steel in it. I guess we're just going to have to wait for that one.
Jean works here with his five brothers. They all live together, along with his wife and five kids, in a nearby shack he built out of found debris. Their old home is too damaged to live in. Jean doesn't want to be here. He just wants his old life back.
We were way, way more comfortable before. Here we don't sleep well at all. The floor of our house is, well, dirt, and we don't have beds. Everybody's squished together, and there's an odor of dead bodies from the debris, because sometimes they drop them here by accident.
Jean is an electrician, and he used to sell rat traps with his brothers. But with little electricity and less opportunity after the quake, the Jean family turned to rubble salvage. These days, two pickup truck loads of rebar fetch less than $10.
We can't even make a fourth of what we used to be able to make. Think about it. Once the debris stops, we stop. And then we don't have anything.
Jean wears pink Crocs on his feet while he works, and always manages to smile in spite of it all. When the flow of rubble dries up, he says he'll be happy to look for other work.
I don't
feel good at all about doing this. I don't feel good about having to make a living off of people who have lost so much.
When the rubble salvagers of Port-au-Prince gather a big enough heap of metal, they haul it here, to a company called Haiti Recycling. This is where the scraps are sold. Workers climb over stacks of junk, sorting everything in a big shed. Stanley Sajous and his family run this place. They've been getting a steady stream of steel from the rubble sites.
Most of the people that bring them in are the people of off the street, you know, they're poor people, you know, and they're making the best of the situation. You got to rebuild, so you got to clean up first anyway. I could say nobody wants to profit from, you know, such a disaster, but after a while, you know, everybody has to continue life and continue moving on and making something out of nothing.
Back at the dump, things have finally started to pick up for Aurélas Jean and his brothers. They've laid claim to a giant tangled ball of rebar, and they're trying to separate the pieces by sawing through the ropes of steel. Half a dozen men surround the rusty jumble, puzzling over it like a Rubik's Cube they can't quite solve. On the other side of the dump, one of the Jean brothers uses a mallet to pound a concrete column that's full of good rebar. He says it might take him 2 hours to separate the steel. Aurélas Jean will then add it to the growing pile of scrap rebar in front of the family shack.
Every
time we look at that steel, It reminds me that my house is like that too. I can't go in there anymore, just like this person can't go in theirs. We're just doing this work for now, until we see what God has planned for us.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
You can see photos on our website at worldvisionreport.org. The eyes of the world have been on the Winter Olympics in Canada, so what better platform to raise money for Haiti? Reporter Sadie Babbitts has been covering the games. She met a snowboarder who's using the slopes and the stage to help Haitians. Here's Sadie's reporter's notebook.
Just days before the Winter Games started, I took a bus 2 hours north from Vancouver to come here to Whistler. This ski town is the site of all the Olympic sledding, alpine skiing, and Nordic events. I end up at the base of Blackcomb Mountain, where the ski run swoops down right into Whistler Village. I point my mic toward a lone snowboarder slicing down the mountain.
That's the sound of the shredding for Haiti. I'm riding for Haiti.
This is how I meet Costaman. Yes, that really is his name.
Yeah, I'm a reggae artist from Whistler.
This Greek-Canadian has long dreadlocks and a full-size Haitian flag hanging from his shoulders. So when he comes down the mountain, he looks a little like a Cape Crusader. He says he wears the flag to get people's attention. He certainly has mine. He wants people to know he's snowboarding, or as he puts it, shredding for Haiti. He rides his snowboard during the day collecting donations, and at night, he raises donations another way. When he performs with his reggae band, Costaman and the Good Vibrations.
Let's see, so far this week we've raised over 3,000, and we hope to do another 3 or 4 tonight, and the mountain is going to match us as well. And then the Canadian government will match that, and so our little 3 and 4 and 6 and 10,000 will turn into 20 and 40 easily. So there it is.
It turns out that Costaman is the president of a local nonprofit called Bands Against Hunger. The musicians in the group do a lot of charity work. They even help fund an orphanage in Namibia. Costaman tells me that whenever there's a catastrophe, like the earthquake in Haiti, local musicians and DJs will get together and jam to raise cash. As we get ready to part ways, Costaman invites me to tonight's benefit concert.
We're going to be raising lots of money and dancing, so come and shake your groove thing.
I've noticed other efforts to help survivors of the earthquake in Haiti during these winter games. In downtown Vancouver, I could donate cash in return for a hug. That's being done by a group called What Else? Hugs for Haiti. And the Olympic Truce Wall, a traditional symbol of peace and fair play installed at the Athletes' Village, will be auctioned off after the games to benefit Haiti. I didn't hit the dance floor that night in Whistler with Costaman and the Good Vibrations. I had to catch a bus back down to Vancouver for another assignment. But I hear Costaman raised a lot of cash, and that he continues to jam this week at the Savage Beagle.
Sadie Babbitts is a freelance journalist based in Portland, Oregon. We caught up with Sadie in Vancouver. Well, Sadie, you didn't hit the dance floor with Costaman, but you've been busy following other Olympic stories, and we're interested in hearing about that medical clinic inside the Olympic Village. I hear athletes can use it for everything from broken bones and internal injuries from the games to things like eye checks. So tell us a little about these clinics.
Well, there's actually 2 polyclinics here at the Vancouver Winter Games. When you walk inside, they're huge, and they're filled with state-of-the-art technology. So basically, let's say an athlete comes in with broken ribs. They can have x-rays done there. It's all digital. They can send that information out to another doctor somewhere else in the world to be analyzed. So it's pretty high tech.
Now, obviously, these clinics are intended for athletes who get injured in the games, and there have been some serious injuries. But I understand that some athletes from developing countries are actually using the clinics for routine care. What have you heard about that?
That's right, Peggy, and I think this is really fascinating because the vision and dental services have been booked for weeks in advance from athletes coming from developing countries. And this is a trend that's been actually happening over the last several Olympic Games.
I understand, Sadie, that you haven't been able to actually speak to any of the athletes from the developing countries who are using the clinic, but I think you've spoken to others about how they're using it. What kinds of illnesses or needs or routine care are you hearing that these athletes are using?
They're coming in for everything from, let's say, basic contact lenses to getting their eyes checked, or also just finding out different information. For example, at the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing, the polyclinic provided vision care services and contact lenses to athletes, including coaches and staff. And they also did a lot of educational videos in many different languages, just simply on routine eye care, because it's something that athletes in especially developing countries aren't really paying attention to. But what's interesting is that countries like the U.S. or Canada, which have huge Olympic teams coming here, have their own medical support around them. But athletes coming from, say, Peru, and there's one athlete from Peru here, or an athlete from Kenya or Ghana, they are coming with a very, very small support team and no medical staff whatsoever. So what I'm hearing from healthcare workers is that these athletes, say from Ghana and Kenya and Peru, are taking advantage of the free services such as vision and dental, which would be so hard to tap into in their home country.
Why is it so hard to tap into it in their home countries?
Sometimes it's too expensive for athletes who often aren't getting paid to train 24/7 to get ready for the games. Also, in some of these places like Ghana, there simply isn't access for that kind of care. But I did talk to one healthcare worker yesterday who used to do some humanitarian work in Rwanda. She told me that she wished that the kind of technology that athletes in general here at the games are getting would be available to those living in developing nations like Rwanda. She's like, it would make such a big difference.
Sadie Babbitts is just outside the Olympic Village in Vancouver. Sadie, thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you get over that cold of yours.
Thank you very much, Peggy.
And now, our globe at a glance. Afghanistan is celebrating a big win, and it doesn't have to do with the war. The national cricket team just won a place in the World 2020 cricket finals set for May 1st. Hundreds of singing, flag-waving Afghans greeted the team this week as they returned home from the qualifying games in Dubai. Cricket is a relatively new game in Afghanistan. Most players learned it while they were refugees in neighboring Pakistan, where cricket is a national passion. The celebration is a welcome relief for Afghans who've lived through more than three decades of conflict. But the next test for the national team is a tough one. They'll face cricket giants India and South Africa in the playoffs. Whatever the outcome, they'll get plenty of support from fans back home. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. One man finds a solution to a healthcare crisis in Kenya. That story's coming up on the World Vision Report. After a short break, stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. U.S. legislators continue to wrestle with the thorny issue of healthcare reform. It's a huge undertaking, and not just in this country. Ask Scott Hillstrom. He's a former U.S. business executive who's now running healthcare clinics across Kenya and Rwanda. Many believe Hillstrom's model of healthcare in Africa could transform the delivery of life-saving drugs. Scott Hillstrom never intended to tackle healthcare reform. He had had a successful career and was just beginning his dream retirement in New Zealand. That changed when his car crashed on a winding road.
Well, I was lying on the side of the road, and I was suffering from shock, and my body was shaking, and it was a wet and cold day, so hypothermia was a possibility, and there was a lot of blood. While I was laying there, I had the opportunity to sort of size up life from the perspective of being perhaps at the end of it. And I had the very distinct feeling that notwithstanding all of my hard work and accomplishments and accumulated wealth and all those things, that it really didn't count for anything from the perspective of the end of life.
And there you were in retirement in the most beautiful country of your dreams.
So I got on a plane to Africa.
You got on a plane to Africa?
Yes, because I had read that at that time 25,000 children were dying daily, more than 10 million a year in the developing world, and they wouldn't have died if they would have had access to medicine that cost less than a cup of coffee.
That horrible statistic was more than a number. These kids became real to him.
The number of children who die from easily treatable diseases in a day would fill a small stadium. I pictured if these dead children were in my front yard and I had to walk through them to get to my coffee shop or to get into my Lexus and go to the office, would I do anything differently with my life? And of course, anyone would.
In Africa, Scott interviewed everyone possible, ministers, doctors, nonprofit organizations. He found out that parents might walk for hours to get drugs to save their children's lives, but those drugs might well be fakes, because about half the drugs in Africa are counterfeit. And finally, after 2 years, Scott Hillstrom came up with a solution, franchised healthcare.
The insight that hit me one day that made me realize that franchising was the solution to this was the notion that McDonald's sells French fries throughout the world, and wherever you buy them, they are of a consistent quality standard. The problem with drugs in rural Africa is that they are not of a consistent quality standard. And so I thought, if 25,000 children were dying every day because they did not have access to life-saving French fries, what would the solution be? And of course, it would be McDonald's.
Create McDonald's.
Right. So I went to a McDonald's, a friend who owns several McDonald's, and I asked him, how does McDonald's maintain that consistent quality standard throughout the world when they're producing billions of French fries every day with maybe a million people working on it? And McDonald's had the answer.
What was the answer?
The answer is to simply franchise a chain of medical clinics in the areas where these kids are doing all the dying.
Here's why there's such a problem.
The health workers who are currently working in the system have incentives to do things that are not helpful. For example, it's very common that doctors and nurses and other health workers in a government hospital will remove medicine from the hospital and sell it on the black market themselves. And I used to think, isn't that awful? That's terrible corruption, until I got to thinking about what I would do if I were them. If I were a nurse working in a hospital and I had five children and their only hope out of the dismal circumstances of their lives was to get an education and school fees were expensive, I might do the same thing. So I thought, is there a way to realign the incentives of the health worker so that they are incentivized to do what we want them to do? And that's really the magic of franchising. We create a valuable business opportunity for a nurse practitioner to own and operate her own business. It becomes the income that supports her family, and it also becomes a status symbol for her as the owner of a high-quality medical clinic in her community. But then we say to her, here's a rule system. It specifies exactly how you diagnose patients, how you handle drugs. It allows you to buy only the drugs that we supply because we have a secure supply chain, so we know the drugs are good. And then we say, as long as you follow these rules, you can continue to own and operate this franchise business. But if you don't follow them, we will revoke your franchise.
So that's like at McDonald's, if you make mushy French fries, you lose your franchise.
That's right. Or even if you don't keep your restrooms clean, McDonald's will come and take away your golden arches.
Okay, so you set up these clinics, you incentivize nurses and health workers to be there and not give counterfeit drugs, so they must make more money than they do in the government hospitals or clinics.
Well, that's the basic idea. As long as that franchise business they own is worth too much to risk losing it by breaking rules, they tend to follow the rules.
I'm assuming you've had to really turn around a deeply culturally entrenched way of doing medicine in these villages. How do you get the people to trust your clinics? Because that's not what they've normally gone to.
I've gone there myself and I've asked patients, why do you come here? And the best example, I think, is in Kibera, which is the largest slum in Africa, where we have two clinics. I've asked several mothers, why do you come to our clinic rather than going to the other place down the road where you get medicine and treatment for free? And they give the same answer. When I bring my kids to your clinic, they get well. And when I take them somewhere else, sometimes they get well, and sometimes they don't.
Now, is that because of the counterfeit medicine?
Well, it's because of the substandard medicine, and most of that is counterfeit medicine. The other thing they say is that we're more convenient. If you're a mother with five children in a slum in Africa, time is really precious. You have to collect sticks for fires and gather food and make sure the kids get to school if they can go to a school. You really don't want to spend a whole day standing in a line at a government clinic hoping to see a doctor or a nurse who might give you medicine, and if they do, it might not work. Much better to go to one of our clinics and be in and out in 15 or 20 minutes with high-quality medicine.
Where do you all get your drugs, and how do you make them affordable to people who live off so little?
The key to it is to purchase drugs from a secure source. By secure, I mean a source that you can be certain has not been penetrated by counterfeit drugs. And then to protect that supply chain from the point of purchase all the way out to the medical clinic. And then to ensure that inside the clinic, the drugs are being kept under lock and key and they're being managed properly.
What keeps you from expanding this model rapidly and all over the developing world?
A franchise system to be developed right is a long and arduous process. We've been at it 10 years, and we are now the same size that Subway sandwich franchise was at our age of 10 years, 85 clinics. But our goal is to be the size that Subway is today, which is 30,000 locations.
Scott Hillstrom is founder of the healthcare clinic franchise in Africa called CFW Clinics. That's short for Child and Family Wellness. For more information, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. Now to a story about a little mental health care in New York City. That's where a group of women who have been victims of domestic violence received a special Valentine's treat. Reporter Lily Jamali explains why, for these ladies, a little pampering goes a long way. One note, the women's names in this story have been changed to protect their identities.
Last summer, Carrie left her boyfriend of 4 years.
He was really, really hard on drugs, and if I didn't have money to give him or if he didn't find the way to get it, I was basically the punching bag.
So in July, the 24-year-old packed a small bag, snuck out, and hopped a bus back home to New York City with her four young children.
I looked at myself in the mirror, and it hurt to see me like that. It hurt to see me so thin. I looked so depressed. I looked so bad.
Carrie's been living in a domestic violence shelter while she tries to reestablish her life. But on the day before Valentine's Day, she got a break.
I'm just going to blend this eyeliner.
Carrie and other women from the shelter got to leave their kids for the day and head to Manhattan to receive head-to-toe makeovers. Each year, an organization called Reveal brings together professional hairstylists, makeup artists, and fashionistas. Their goal? To make these women feel beautiful again. This year's event is being held in the offices of a local charity.
We're going to start you off with some cleansing, and then we have toning and moisturizers, so we're going to make your skin feel nice and great before you get a massage. So,
Carrie starts with a skin specialist. A few feet away, a makeup artist consults with a shelter resident named Elaine.
Have you ever filled in your eyebrows before?
No.
We'll do a real soft color, but it'll make a nice big difference.
For Elaine, this is a first.
I never put makeup on, ever. And I'm 42.
All this is happening in a large room that today has the intimate feel of a neighborhood beauty parlor. A stylist works a curling iron on Denise, a 21-year-old who's raising a child on her own.
I can do it without him, and I'm going to be all right.
That's right. Starting with this bombshell here. Little by little, right?
Yeah.
Back at the makeup station, Elaine gets to see the result of her first makeover.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is so nice.
I just wanted to make sure that
oh, you did wonderfully.
Oh, you look gorgeous.
Thank you.
Your makeup still
I look
nice
like
and
another
light.
A different person. I like me.
And that, says Reveal organizer Melanie Koppel, is a common reaction here.
When they first come in, they're a little timid. They sit back, and by the time they go through the rotation, they are joking around. They're ready to do the catwalk.
Upstairs, a professional photographer takes each woman's photo.
Chin down, eyes open, and look at me with intention. There you go.
The photo is printed up on the spot.
Wow, my mother is going to love this.
She's going to love it.
By the time the women start heading home to their shelter, the transformation is on full display. One woman stands in the doorway and belts it out like Beyonce.
You're going to love me.
I loved it. I mean, I couldn't cry because of my makeup.
Her kids might be young, but Carrie knows they pay attention to whether she takes care of herself.
I just want them to see me. I want to see their expressions on their face. It's going to be different.
On the way out, there are many thank yous.
You're very much welcome.
God bless you, okay?
You're welcome, thank you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, same to you.
And vows to treat themselves next Valentine's Day when they're hopefully back on their feet. For the World Vision Report, I'm Lily Jamali in New York.
She was a beautiful woman. She was a beautiful woman.
Our reporter, Will Everett, was on assignment in India recently when an important interview he'd scheduled got sidetracked. It's the kind of thing a reporter might expect when working in a different culture with its own customs and etiquette. But the event that derailed Will's interview on this day caught him completely off guard. Here's Will's reporter's notebook.
It was pretty annoying. I was in India, and the person I'd traveled all day to interview had decided to take me to an awards ceremony at an organization she volunteered with. What she didn't mention was that the ceremony was all in Hindi and would keep us there for several hours. I didn't know anything about the organization, except that the 100 or so women in attendance were extremely devoted to its cause. They'd put me on the front row, clearly a place of honor, and from time to time the speaker would proudly refer in English to our foreign guest. I sat and stewed, waiting for the ceremony to end. But then an old man with an accordion-like instrument got up and sang for half an hour. Then there were more speeches. Then the whole auditorium went into a Hindu chant. I mouthed along, pretending that I knew what was going on, as women in saris looked at me and smiled. Then there were more speeches. A woman came up and pinned a blue ribbon on my chest. For what? I didn't have a clue. I looked at the signs and posters, all in Hindi, and couldn't make heads or tails of where I was or what this was all about. And then it happened. The worst thing that could have possibly happened.
Now, we have with us William Everett. He's from USA. And I would like that he come here and share his experiences. Please come.
They wanted me to give a speech. I was supposed to say something meaningful about the work of this organization. I stood up, looking frantically for the woman who'd brought me here, but she was nowhere to be seen. The room got quiet as I approached the podium.
Does anyone speak English? Okay. Anyone? No one speaks English?
Most of them had no idea what I was saying. That was a relief. So for the next 5 minutes, I just talked about whatever was in my head. India, the crazy bus ride that morning, the stories I'd been working on. Their faces were radiant as they nodded along to what I was saying. When I was done, the women were wiping their eyes with emotion. Now I wondered more than ever, what was this organization all about? Afterward, there was coffee and dessert in an adjoining room. Everyone congratulated me in broken English on my fine speech. My host appeared, and I took her aside and asked, "Where am I anyway?" Turns out, this was an organization that sought to end violence against women in India. And these women were all victims of violence. And it wasn't an awards ceremony at all, but a kind of pep rally for women who'd overcome great obstacles and were now working to carry the message of nonviolence throughout India. My host had used me. I was simply there to help these women feel recognized for what they'd been through and what they'd done. But by now, my initial annoyance was gone. And it felt sort of good to be used.
Texas.
Oh. Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. You've heard of fortune tellers, but what about fortune-telling parrots? They've got them in Pakistan. Jessica Partnow had one read her fortune, and she tells us about it in our latest street vendor story.
At Clifton Beach in Karachi, you can ride a camel or a roller coaster. Dip your feet in the Arabian Sea, or ask a little green parrot to predict your future. Kadim Hussein Shah uses a bird to tell fortunes. The 62-year-old is sitting on a small carpet at the side of the road. He's laid out a row of tattered envelopes at his feet. A 2-year-old green parrot sits in a cage behind him. First, you tell Shah your name.
Inka naam Jessica hai. James.
Aaja.
Next, he lets the bird out of the cage and tells it your name. Then it walks up to the envelope containing your fortune and gives it to its master. Shah studies the Urdu character scribbled onto the card before he starts to read.
He's saying, don't worry about making money or being wealthy, because it will come to you.
No problem.
He said
there won't be any problems for you in business this year. You can pursue any sort of enterprise or, you know, trade or, you know, buying and selling, any of those things.
It's a pretty good fortune. I'm ready for the checks to start rolling in. But don't fortune tellers always tell you what you want to hear?
I don't believe in just saying things for the sake of saying them. The parrot is specially trained to pick up cards according to your name. I don't make big promises. I don't say, you will go to Saudi Arabia and become a rich man, or anything like that.
Shah usually brings home 100 rupees, or $1.75 each day. He says it's enough to get by. And he says he enjoys his work. But for Orthodox Muslims, this kind of fortune-telling is forbidden because it's seen as superstitious. But Shah disagrees.
There is nothing against this in our religion. But palmistry is a sin. If anyone reads a palm or has theirs read, their prayers will not be heard for 40 days.
Shah always sends his customers home with a Quran verse to meditate on to help their fortunes come true. Which reminds me, I was supposed to read the Quran and pray every day for 2 weeks. Maybe that's why the business deals haven't started rolling in yet. From Karachi, I'm Jessica Partnow for the World Vision Report.
We go to China next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. More than 1,000 young boys have gone missing in rural China over the last few years. But desperate parents have had little success going to the police. Instead, they form their own search parties to find their sons. Paul Mooney is a freelance reporter living in China. He's been following this story and joins us from Beijing. Paul, many Americans haven't heard anything about what's going on in China with these boys. Can you tell us what's happening, how these boys are just disappearing?
The bulk have disappeared in Hunan province. A lot of them are looking for jobs. They congregate around the train station. They're approached by people who offer them work in factories, and they jump on a van and then disappear.
So what is actually happening to these boys?
What's happening is that there are hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of these brick kilns in the countryside in China. There's a kind of a boom in the countryside. Farmers are building new houses, and there's a huge business in supplying bricks. These kilns were set up. A lot of them were illegal, producing bricks very cheaply, and they were using slave labor. They were picking kids up off the street in cities around Henan and in Shaanxi provinces.
So they're just kidnapping these boys to work in kilns?
That's right. In some cases, they've been physically taken off the street. There was one young boy who, around 15, a middle school student, wasn't even looking for work. Three women approached him on the street, asked him if he was looking for work. He said, no, just waiting for friends. And they grabbed him and forced him into a van. And the next day, he turned up in one of these black kilns. He was rescued about 2 months later.
How long has this been going on?
It's been going on for years. There's one case of a man who got out recently, but he was in a kiln for 14 years working. They say it goes back to the Qing Dynasty, though, and it probably stopped during the heady kind of political days of communist China, but it's come back quite strong in recent years. And I think it's a sign of the economy you know, that that people want to, you know, to kind of get rich kind of anyway, and they're ruthless and don't care. So if it means that you kidnap, you know, children off the street, then that's something that they're willing to do.
Now, I would think that the government is taking action against this. If you've got all these boys being kidnapped off the streets and taken to kilns, what's happening in China over this? Are the officials going after the kiln owners, or is it just in the parents' hands?
It's pretty much in the parents' hands. The police have been very slow to react. In 2007, it broke on the internet and it became a huge story. And the government came out, they closed some of the kilns, they arrested a few people, and then it just ended. It's estimated that about 1,000 young men are missing. I was told that only about 50% had been found. So there's still another, say, 500 or 600. But even those numbers might be quite conservative. We have no idea because, you know, a lot of parents may not have reported their kids missing.
You know, it must be horrible for parents when any child is missing. But in China, there's the one-child policy. And so if you have one child and it's a boy and he gets kidnapped, I would imagine it's quite a trauma for these parents.
Sure. Yeah, I spent a whole day visiting about 15 kilns with the farmers. They basically, because the police haven't done anything to help them or very little, they formed their own vigilante groups to go out and search the kilns. And basically, the kilns exist in the countryside. They're in huge kind of, you know, in the farm fields. They work 10-hour days. They work all day, rain or shine. There were even big lights hung up on poles so that they can work at nighttime.
Do any of these boys try to escape?
It's difficult to escape, and they get beaten if they escape. But some people do manage to escape. There's one young man that I met in Zhengzhou, the capital of Henan province, who escaped three times. The first time he escaped, he went to the local town and went to the Labor Affairs Bureau to report what had happened. The official took him to another kiln and sold him. He escaped again a few months later, made it back to the same town, and the first person he saw was the same official who took him to another kiln and sold him. So the official sold him twice. He was sold altogether three times. And I met him. I had lunch with him. His spirit is completely broken. He's afraid to go out of the restaurant that he works in.
Well, you mentioned these vigilante squads because the police aren't doing much. These parents, you can understand why they would form these squads. And you followed them, you say. Tell us a little bit about what this group of parents is doing.
Yeah, well, there's about 40 families that are working together. They get together about once a month, and they go out together in kind of, I guess, numbers give them a bit of safety. And they pick a certain area, and they would go out for 3, 4, 5 days a week and hit different areas, going through the kilns, walking into buildings, dormitories, you know, just looking around for their children. And actually, they're quite organized, you know, like a SWAT team. The way they go through, they're very experienced at doing this and fearless because they're looking for their children.
And how often do parents in these squads actually find their boys?
Well, this group saved about 100 boys in the year 2007. But that's around the same time that the government cracked down. Some of the kilns became legal. Some of them may have sold the kids deeper inside China to other industries, maybe the steel industry or coal mines, which is quite dangerous. And so since 2007, they haven't actually found many more young men.
Now, Paul, I know you've interviewed some of the parents, spent time with them. Any story that comes to mind about one family or a set of parents that you'd want to share with us?
Yeah, you know, the farmer who a man named Yuan Cheng, who kind of organizes these visits to the kilns. I traveled to his house. It was heartbreaking to go there. I met him, his wife, his brother. The family's heartbroken. You know, 2 years ago, you know, there's no jobs for a lot of these kids. The school was several hours walk away. A lot of these kids are drawn to go work in the cities. And when his son was 15, he'd gotten a job working on a construction site in Zhengzhou. Left, and 2 weeks later, his friends called and said he disappeared. He was asked to go to the 14th floor of this construction site to deliver a tool, and he never came back again. And the father has been tireless in going out every month searching for his son. But he's, you know, it's sad because I talk to the father, as I did with the other parents, and often he just kind of, he's talking, he's smiling, he's forgotten about his problem, and then all of a sudden his face kind of clouds and he's distant, he's far, far away, he drinks a lot now. A lot of the men that I met that lost their sons have become heavy drinkers. They drink a kind of a distilled Chinese liquor. You know, they just start crying when they describe what happened. They have no idea where their kids are or the kids. And they said to me, I don't know if my son is alive. Is he being abused? Is he injured? They have no idea. And that's very painful for a parent.
Of course, very painful. And I'm assuming they go to all kinds of authorities pleading for help. What feedback are they getting?
They're basically getting none. The police basically tell them, you know, there are a lot of kids who have disappeared. We don't have time to look into this. Even Yuan Cheng, who had gotten some ransom phone calls and went to the police with a phone number, and the police ignored him. He had other evidence. Another boy had been kidnapped from that same construction site a few days earlier, who had managed to escape. The police never interviewed the boy. The police never went to the construction site to interview the foreman or any of the workers. They did nothing. You know, in a lot of cases, it's believed that the police are working, or local governments are working with the kilns. These are local industries.
Well, it doesn't sound like there's much hope on the horizon, Paul. Have you talked to the parents lately about any new strategies they have, or any new developments at all that might indicate they'll eventually find their boys?
No, I think it's actually gotten even more difficult. When we visited the kilns, my feeling was that the kiln owners realized they couldn't keep these Chinese kids anymore, and so they went looking for minority kids. They're from further away. Their parents probably won't even know where they are, don't have the ability to come search for them. And the parents were very, very disappointed when they saw this, because then they realized that their kids may have been sold to other provinces, to other industries. So it went from searching kilns in two provinces to maybe searching coal mines, steel factories, other types of industries in many, many provinces. And that's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And Yuan Cheng, so it was very sad. He told me the last day, he said, the longer my son's gone, the less I can remember things about him. But he said, it's my duty as a father to keep searching for him, so he won't give up.
Paul Mooney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Mooney is a freelance reporter living in Beijing. He wrote an article about the kidnapped boys for the South China Morning Post. You can read it on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Millions of young people in rural China voluntarily leave their homes and families each year. They move from the country to urban areas, hoping to find jobs. Author Leslie Chang wrote about rural girls who flock to the city's factories. Chang was born in America, but spent a decade in China as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. In her book, Factory Girl, Chang tells the story of Min. Min worked in a factory making alarm clocks and calculators. She slept in a cramped dorm with 11 other workers, and she made about $50 a month. But Min wanted more. Here's a reading from Leslie Chang's book, Factory Girls.
She phoned home and said she was thinking of quitting her job. Her parents, who farmed a small plot of land and had three younger children still in school, advised against it. "You always want to jump from this place to that place," her father said. "Girls should not be so flighty. Stay in one place and save some money," he told her. Min suspected this was not the best advice. "Don't worry about me," she told her father. "I take care of myself." She had two true friends in the factory now, Liang Rong and Huao Zhao'e, who were both a year older than Min. They washed Min's clothes for her on the nights she went to class. Laundry was a constant chore because the workers had only a few changes of clothes. In the humid dark nights after the workday ended, long lines of girls filed back and forth from the dormitory bathrooms carrying buckets of water. Once you had friends, life in the factory could be fun. On rare evenings off, the three girls would skip dinner and go roller skating, then return to watch a late movie at the factory. As autumn turned into winter, the cold in the unheated dorms kept the girls awake at night. Min dragged her friends into the yard to play badminton until they were warm enough to fall asleep. The 2004 Lunar New Year fell in late January. Workers got only 4 days off, not enough time to go home and come out again. Min holed up in her dorm and phoned home 4 times in 2 days. After the holiday, she went to her boss again, and this time, he let her leave. Liang Rong and Huao Zhao'e cried when Min told them her news. In a city of strangers, they were the only ones who knew about her departure. They begged her to stay. They believed that conditions at other factories were no better, and that to leave or to stay would be the same in the end. Min did not think so. She promised she would return for a visit after she got paid at her new job. Min left that same day, with a few clothes and a backpack, and the 2 months' wages that the factory owed her. She did not take her towels and bedding with her, Those things had cost money, but she couldn't bear the sight of them anymore. In 10 months on the assembly line, Min had sent home 3,000 yuan, about $360, and made two true friends. She should have been scared, but all she knew was that she was free.
That was a reading from Factory Girls by Leslie Chang. And here's what Factory Girls and other Chinese are listening to this week. Ha Ha Lili by the popular Chinese pop star Sa Ding Ding. Sa Ding Ding's second album, Harmony, was released last month on iTunes and shot immediately to the top of the iTunes charts. China mass produces most of the toys you'll find in stores these days, but if you're looking for intricate handcrafted toys made in local workshops, you may have to go to Oaxaca, Mexico. That's where Shannon Young met up with Miguel Ramirez, who's been making toys by hand for 40 years.
Public celebrations like New Year's Eve and Independence Day draw huge crowds to Oaxaca City's central square. The celebrations include fireworks, live music, and playful fights with spray foam. By the time the party is over, empty aerosol cans blanket the square. It's an amazing amount of litter, but not all of it ends up in a landfill.
So we pick it up as much as we can. We're able to gather around 10, 15, even 20 sacks full. And they last us all year.
That's local artist Miguel Ramirez. More than four decades ago, he started turning these cans into toy airplanes, helicopters, trains, antique cars, and even UFOs. Mr. Ramirez has a toy workshop in his home where he shows me how he turns the empty spray cans into raw material for his creations. He takes one of the cans out of a sack, holds down the valve to release any remaining air, then knocks the valve off. Then he hammers the tip of a knife into the upper side of the can and cuts off its top. Ramirez uses the tops to make the wheels for his trains and cars. Next, he cuts off the bottom of the can. Bottoms make good reflectors. Then he slices up the can's metal seam with scissors.
Then you open it up, then flatten the metal.
Ramirez uses a thick piece of wood to do that.
From there, you wash it with a good amount of water. Once it's clean, you let it dry, shine it with newspaper, and then fold over the edges.
He makes sure to leave no sharp edges. What he can't fold into his side seam, he smooths over with a sanding wheel. Ramirez transforms the sheet metal into car chassis, steam engine chimneys, and decorative ladders for his UFOs. Solder holds everything together. All of his creations, which can be up to 2 feet long, have moving parts and some make sounds, like this airplane.
That's what gets the attention of children and even adults.
Ramirez and his wife take to the streets occasionally to sell their pieces, but it's a bit tricky. They don't have an expensive street vendor's license, so they have to do their selling while walking. They cradle a model or two in their arms while carrying others in tote bags slung over their shoulders. Patricia Diaz has bought several pieces from Ramirez and recalls the first time she saw him and his wife.
I saw them walk by selling these toys, these objects made from sheet metal. I went downstairs to inquire and they had already walked ahead. I almost lost them, but I caught up and, well, I really liked what they had. It's really lovely and well done work.
The work is also very labor-intensive. Miguel Ramirez says he can produce 6 trains or cars in 1 month. He repairs electronic appliances to supplement the family income, but says his heart is in his handcrafted artwork.
The work is very labor-intensive, but it's worthwhile. I feel good doing this work.
One of his handmade cars or trains costs about $50. That's about the same as a remote-controlled vehicle or a brand-name plastic toy truck of the same size. The big difference being, the metal toy is more likely to survive an entire childhood. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
And you can see photos of the handcrafted toys on our website, worldvisionreport.org. While you're there, you can download a podcast of the show and read blogs from our reporters around the world. And you can post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Our engineering assistant is Emily Eagle. Production assistant is Chris Baldiga, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us again next week.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children.
Foto viva, viva.